Hezbollah's leader says the U.S. move to halt support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen shows the resistance of the Yemeni people has borne fruit. Head of the International Atomic Energy Agency offers to visit Iran over Tehran's decision to suspend IAEA snap inspections. And Myanmar's junta files a new charge against a deposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi and extends an internet shutdown in an attempt to quell anti-coup protests. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says U.S. move to halt support for the Saudi-led war coalition shows the resistance of the Yemeni people has borne fruit. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah welcomed the decision by the Biden administration as a positive move, even if only in rhetoric. He added, Yemeni resistance is right to be apprehensive and cautious about the U.S. announcement, as the enemy will try to push a different scheme after failing to achieve its objectives in its protracted war on Yemen. Nasrallah also held the steadfastness of the Yemeni people, popular fighters, and allied army units against years of Saudi-led aggression and blockade. Meanwhile, head of Yemen's Answer the Movement has once again called on the Saudi-led coalition to end its deadly onslaught and blockade on the country. Spokesperson for the Nasrallah, Muhammad Abdul Salam, said the movement wants a political solution to the long-running crisis in the country. However, he said the prior experiences show no political process will yield results while the aggression and siege of Yemen continues. He was responding to a U.S. request for the group to cease all military operations and participate in international efforts to find a political solution. The U.S. also called on the Ansarullah to halt its offensive on the city of Ma'arib and end strikes on Saudi Arabia. Yemeni army has recently intensified its retaliatory attacks against the Saudi-led coalition. Yemeni forces are reportedly at the gates of Ma'arib, last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen. Head of the International Atomic Energy Agency has offered to visit Iran after Tehran informed the UN body of its decision to end voluntary implementation of the additional protocol. Now, the IAEA said in a statement that Rafael Grossi seeks to find a solution for the agency to continue to carry out its verification work. Iran's parliament passed a law in December which requires the government to block the IAEA snap inspections as of February 23rd, among other measures, if sanctions are not lifted by then. Iran and the U.S. are locked in a standoff over salvaging the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, with both sides calling on the other to act first. Homolezgi says IAEA Director General is trying to find a solution with Tehran concerning how the agency is going to conduct its verification work in the country.
The IAEA Director General, Rafael Grossi, said that he is willing to travel to Iran. He has made that offer, he said, to travel to Iran to be able to come to, in his words, some kind of a solution concerning how the agency is going to conduct its verification work in Iran. As of yet, no date has been set for this visit. It looks like that both sides are in consultations, agreeing on a possible trip by IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi, which would be his second since he took office, his second trip to Iran. And what's of note here is that Iran will dramatically reduce the level of its cooperation with the agency if by the 23rd of February sanctions are not lifted and the JCPOA is not revived. So any access that the agency has based on the text of the JCPOA, it no longer will have.
The United Nations Special Rapporteur for Myanmar has warned about a potential escalation of violence in the country during the post-coup era. Tom Andrews said that he has received reports that soldiers were being transported to the city of Yangon, where people are expected to hold a protest against the coup d'etat. The UN official noted that such military presence in Myanmar has historically led to killings, disappearances, and mass detentions. The warning comes as the military junta imposed a third straight overnight internet shutdown in a bid, that is, to quell the uprising there. In the meantime, the country's civilian de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, was hit with a second charge. The military detained her along with a number of other political figures over what it called election fraud earlier this month. Nationwide street protests have been held since. Former U.S. President Donald Trump urges Republican senators to remove Mitch McConnell as their leader. In a statement, Trump slammed a senior Republican as a sullen political hack. He also blamed the Kentucky senator for the Republicans' loss of control over the Senate, saying the party can never win again with leaders like him. Scathing criticism came after McConnell accused the former president of bearing responsibility for the January 6th deadly march on the U.S. Capitol. The lower house of Congress voted on January 13th to impeach Trump for incitement to insurrection. However, he was acquitted in the Senate on Saturday. Now, just months after quitting his job, he's back in the spotlight. Dominic Cummings, the UK Prime Minister's former right-hand man, accused of cronyism while he was chief of staff at number 10 Downing Street. Saeed Puruza has all your details.
Alleged favoritism at the heart of the British government, committed by Dominic Cummings, the former top aide to Prime Minister Boris Johnson. UK High Court documents suggest he played an instrumental role in awarding a lucrative contract to a polling firm run by his friends in March last year. There was no formal contract, prior advertisement, or competitive tender process. After only a shake of hands, Public First, a company run by two former colleagues of Cummings and Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove, was paid £540,000 out of the public purse in March last year to research Britain's understanding of the coronavirus and the government's messaging around the pandemic. What started as an informal contract was only formalized retrospectively in June 5 and publicized a week later.
Yet another black mark against the government in its whole handling of the COVID-19 crisis and other situations in which there seem to have been shortcuts made, handing out very large contracts, very valuable contracts indeed, to friends and even family of Conservative ministers or donors to the Conservative Party.
The story was first revealed by The Guardian and Open Democracy in July last year, but was brushed aside as nonsense. In a written statement to the UK High Court, which he did not attend, Cummings admitted he was friends with the company's directors, but denied he recommended them for that reason. He claimed there had been no time to follow usual procurement rules, and the work was crucial to the government's early pandemic response. But the Good Law Project, the not-for-profit campaign group that has brought the judicial review of the contract, disagrees, saying money paid to associates on a handshake and formalized later is unlawful.
Quite frankly, it's not acceptable that there has to be a robust system in place which ensures that all contracts are awarded to companies on the basis of their performance and not on the basis of who they know.
The judge in the case is yet to fix a date for a ruling, but the Good Law Project say they're determined that the truth should see the light of day. Although the government is desperate to keep this and similar cases under wraps for their considerable public importance. Saeed Puruza, London.
Several European countries have reported more infections and deaths as the coronavirus and its new variants keep raging through the continent. Britain reported over 10,000 new cases and 800 deaths in the last day, up from Monday's figures, that despite a new lockdown put in place throughout the country since early January. The UK has the highest coronavirus death toll in Europe, with over 118,000 fatalities. Italy also recorded nearly 400 new deaths and over 10,000 new infections in the past 24 hours. Figures pushed the country's total caseload to more than 2.7 million and deaths to over 94,000. Elsewhere in Europe, Denmark registered a new contagious variant and 45% of those testing positive with the coronavirus. Denmark has reported over 200,000 COVID cases and over 2,300 deaths so far. A Dutch appeals court upholds a 9 p.m. coronavirus curfew pending a full court hearing on the legality of the government's restrictions on Friday. Earlier on Tuesday, a Hague-based court ruled that the government of the Netherlands must immediately lift the curfew. It ruled that the Dutch government has abused its emergency powers, accusing it of violating the right to freedom of movement and privacy. The tribunal also said that Prime Minister Mark Rutte's administration has breached the right to freedom of assembly and demonstration. Now, the Netherlands imposed a coronavirus-related curfew in late January, sparking riots unprecedented in decades. Countries recorded over a million cases of COVID and roughly 15,000 virus-related fatalities. The European Commission forecasts a wave of businesses in the EU will go bankrupt as governments have withdrawn COVID-19 financial support. Problems with the bloc's vaccination strategy are contributing to economic uncertainty, Jerome Hughes reports.
EU finance ministers have just concluded 2 days of talks relating to the 27-country bloc's dire economic situation resulting from the COVID-19 pandemic.
It has been a particular challenge for young women and men, but also those who are employed in contact-intensive parts of our economies.
One such person is Simon Ledoux, who worked in the hospitality industry in Brussels. He feels abandoned by the state since losing his job.
I feel very depressed. I'm looking for a job, but I didn't find. And my friends, like me, didn't find job.
The social crisis in the EU continues to deepen. Richer member states are being urged to support poorer ones. Within the EU, social rights campaigners say solidarity is now needed like never before in the bloc's history, because of huge disparities among member states in terms of their ability to cope and recover. The European Commission warns a record number of businesses will go under when governments start easing financial aid programs. The Commission claims firms that were not viable prior to the crisis will be impacted most. Only six EU nations have so far submitted draft plans to draw down money from a 750 billion euro coronavirus recovery fund.
I call on the remaining countries to ratify the own resources decision quickly so that the Commission can start its borrowing program under the Next Generation EU.
Illegal US sanctions against Iran preventing EU businesses from trading with the Islamic Republic show how the dollar is too dominant over the euro. Eurozone finance ministers have been encouraged to strengthen the currency's position on the international stage.
Recent episodes where the dollar was used as a policy tool reminded us that this is not good from a European perspective.
Economists warn the biggest threat to the Eurozone economy right now is the EU's dysfunctional COVID-19 vaccination strategy. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After months of debate, the French Parliament has voted a new law against the so-called separatism. Now, with the new law, French Muslim community feels targeted and human rights associations fear new attack on the freedom of expression. Our Paris correspondent has your story.
After months of discussion and some rough debates, members of the French Parliament have voted a new law, officially called the Law on Principles of the Republic. French authorities say they want to strengthen the respect of equality, fraternity and liberty, but the opposition denounces, as it was called first, the law on separatism. They sound the alarm on the stigmatization of the Muslim community.
More and more children do not go to the same schools because of the social origin of their parents. That's school separatism. Without saying it, this law concerns only our fellow Muslim citizens and creates a debate on identity rather than on social problems. During weeks, this debate has been a festival of discrimination towards Muslims.
French Interior Minister Darmanin already said that mosques will be closely monitored. Law experts say that this text can be interpreted in different ways, which could lead to arbitrary decisions like the closure of watchdog associations defending the rights of Muslims. Opposition members in the parliament blame the government for not being concerned about the real social problems of the population.
Oui, il y a séparatisme.
Yes, there is a separatism in this country, a separatism in school and on the French territory. This bill does not speak about it. Our children, depending on which school they go to, do not have the same chances. The public school is weakened.
The opposition group in the French parliament also criticizes the actual French government for seducing far-right voters, as the new French president will be elected in only a year. What is more important, security issues or social welfare?
On a vécu deux ans.
We had 2 years of social agitation with a yellow vest movement and a movement against the retirement law. The poverty and social inequality are exploding in France. But no, they debate on the headscarf.
The reaction of the Muslim community is taking form, but slowly and in a dispersed order. Hundreds demonstrated in Paris, and hundreds of religious leaders and human rights associations asked members of parliament in a public letter not to vote this law on separatism. The law has been adopted by a majority in the French parliament, but Muslims and human rights defenders already promised to continue the protest. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
Turkey is planning to launch a new cross-border operation against the PKK terrorists in response to recent attack by the group, which left 13 Turkish citizens dead. Rashan Sagalan has more.
Turkish president vowed that the cross-border military operations that Turkish military is conducting against PKK will continue, as he confirmed Ankara's willingness to expand areas of operations from which threats against Turkey are coming. Assuring that the death of 13 Turkish citizens who lost their lives in the Gara attack will strengthen the government's determination to eliminate terrorist groups.
Northern Iraq's Gara province has now been made secure as a result of a 4-day military operation. We will stay in the areas that we have made safe in a bid to avoid similar attacks. Gara was a troubled region. It is taken now and the problem is gone.
Turkish Defense Minister, along with Interior Minister, met with opposition figures Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu and Meral Akşener separately and explained in details the military operation that was conducted in the region. The two ministers also briefed the parliament on the circumstances of the operation and the martyrdom of 13 Turkish citizens on the hands of PKK. Analysts say the meetings and parliament session were in preparation to draft a resolution to grant the Turkish army the permission to hold wide-range cross-border operation in Sinjar and other areas in northern Iraq.
The war between Turkey and the PKK has been going on for decades. However, I think this time a decision is being made to eliminate the group's terrorists wherever they are. The operation will include Sinjar and Kandil areas. I think all political parties will agree on launching a wider cross-border operation despite knowing that such a decision will be met with opposition from European countries and, of course, Turkey's NATO ally, the United States.
Turkey accused the U.S. of siding with terrorists. Turkish president said the U.S. statement concerning the death of 13 Turkish citizens is considered, quote, a joke. Other Turkish politicians and political parties also condemned it, saying the U.S. exposed its cooperation with PKK in such a statement. It seems that, unlike Turkish expectations, the new U.S. administration, like its predecessors, will continue to support the Kurdish groups. Many expect the two NATO allies go into another round of tensions. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
That's a wrap for your latest, everyone. Goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
onto our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The increasing number of children going hungry in Yemen should shock us all into action. More children will die with every day that passes without action, says Brett Wilkins, writer in an article published under the heading, Yet Another Cry for Help. UN report warns millions of Yemeni children face acute malnutrition. Here's the details. Underscoring the urgent need to end a war that is responsible for what it calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis, the United Nations recently published a report warning that more than 2 million Yemeni children under the age of 5 are projected to suffer acute malnutrition in 2021, with 400,000 of them at risk of death if they do not receive desperately needed treatment in time. According to the latest Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, Acute Malnutrition Report, 2,254,663 Yemeni children under 5 years old are so malnourished that they require medical treatment. Of these, 395,195 suffer from severe acute malnutrition, which is potentially fatal. Additionally, 1,155,653 pregnant and breastfeeding women are acutely malnourished. These numbers are yet another cry for help from Yemen, where each malnourished child also means a family struggling to survive, said David Beasley, executive director of the World Food Program, which prepared the report with the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, UNICEF, and the World Health Organization. The crisis in Yemen is a toxic mix of conflict, economic collapse, and a severe shortage of funding. Henrietta Fore, executive director of UNICEF, said that the increasing number of children going hungry in Yemen should shock us all into action. More children will die with every day that passes without action. Qiu Dongyu, who heads the FAO, added that families in Yemen have been in the grip of conflict for too long, and more recent threats such as COVID-19 have only been adding to their relentless plight. Yemen's war, which began in late 2014, has directly or indirectly claimed more than 233,000 lives, according to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Foreign intervention in the conflict has severely exacerbated Yemeni suffering, with thousands of men, women, and children killed by Saudi-led coalition backed by US, and tens of thousands more perishing due to a coalition blockade. Recently, U.S. President Joe Biden announced that the United States, which previously backed the war with weapons, logistical and diplomatic aid, would no longer support Saudi-led offensive operations in Yemen. Although he did not say whether U.S. drone and other air strikes there, which have killed or wounded hundreds of civilians, would continue. Last month, the Biden administration said the U.S. would temporarily freeze arms sales to both Saudi Arabia regime and the United Arab Emirates regime pending further review. In an interview with The Intercept recently, Representative Ro Khanna said that we need a commitment from Biden to use all of his leverage to end the Saudi-led invasion and blockade of Yemen. We need to confirm we have ended all arms sales to the Saudis and that we won't fulfill any outstanding weapons contracts, Khanna added. We need to press for additional humanitarian aid in all parts of Yemen. Despite the recent talk of the U.S. ending support for the war, the Saudi-led coalition has only intensified military maneuvers in Yemen in recent weeks. Saudi warplanes are seen regularly above highly populated urban areas in north of the country, dropping hundreds of tons of weapons, most supplied by the United States regime. In Sa'deh, Hajjeh, and the oil-rich Ma'rib province, more than 150 air strikes using the U.S.-made bombs have been carried out, according to the Yemeni Executive Mine Action Center, an organization backed by the United Nations. These attacks could not happen without a green light from the United States regime, and all the talk about peace and an end to support for Riyadh are little more than talk for the sake of diplomatic consumption. The ongoing blockade on Sana'a International Airport imposed by the Saudi-led coalition and supported by the United States regime has caused the death of more than 80,000 medical patients. More than 450,000 patients still need to travel abroad to receive treatment, according to the Director General of Sana'a International Airport, Khaled Al-Shayef, as well as a number of civil society organizations that participated in a joint press conference recently. According to the Yemeni Ministry of Health, over 3,000 patients registered with the ministry suffer from cardiac abnormalities and urgently need to travel abroad for treatment. Over 12,000 patients with kidney failure need urgent transplants, and more than 65 cases of cancer risk death if they are unable to get treatment outside of Yemen. He confirmed that the airport is completely safe and in complete technical readiness to receive flights, indicating that the only obstacle to reopening the airport and lifting the ban is the intransigence of the coalition countries and the complicity of the United Nations. The United States regime has not only been complicit in supporting Saudi regime attacks, which have killed more than 250,000 people, destroyed infrastructure, and left Yemen one of the most heavily contaminated countries in the world, it has directly assisted in the enforcement of a blockade that has caused Yemen's complete economic collapse.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله
Answering the doubts and questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs
Allah هو ذا الرحمن
Allah
هو ذا المنان
لا إله إلا
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome once again to another program of Questions and Answers on the Islamic Belief. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi, and I'm here with Sayyid Muhsin Naqawi. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for having me.
The question I have received here, Sayyid, it has to do with freedom of speech, in particularly in the West. We say that we have freedom of speech in the Western world. And the question is, where are the limits of freedom of speech? Can we speak about all different topics? Like, for example, the Zionist regime, Israel. And can we talk about the Holocaust, for example, in the West, where we have the slogan of freedom of speech? Can we talk about other sensitive issues like homosexuality, like sexual relationship before marriage, and so on and so forth? Where are the limits? And where are the limits between, it's two questions in one. And where are the limits between freedom of speech and insulting something or someone?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, when we look at the definition of freedom of speech, it is said that it is a principle that supports the freedom of an individual or a community to articulate their opinions and ideas without fear of retaliation. Now, I have a problem with this basic definition of freedom of speech, which has been... This is a technical definition, basically.
What was the retaliation part?
You can say anything without having a fear of
retaliation.
The problem.
So what part do you have problems with?
With this part of retaliation.
Oh, you say it should be there.
There is always a retaliation.
Right.
Obviously, you know, when they say freedom of speech is a principle that supports the freedom of an individual, talking about something without having a freedom, without having a fear of retaliation, obviously, I look at the world from my own viewpoints.
Right.
It's my own look. Others might see this in another way.
Right.
So when I'm saying this freely, it might hurt some people. For example, you know, when we have, when we talk about the...
And when you hurt people, that yes, might have retaliation.
That definitely have
in your career.
Yes.
If you're a university teacher.
Anywhere.
Everything.
Anywhere.
Financial issues.
Also, when there is a freedom of the community talking about anything. For example, you know, nowadays they are raising this Islamophobia in the West. They're talking about Islamophobia. Obviously, Islamophobia has nothing to do, like, this is not the part of Islam, the things that they show in order to expand the phobia amongst the people. And they're fearing people from Islam. But obviously, Islam is against all these things. The point is, when we talk about the freedom of speech should not be defined like this, the way it's been defined. The freedom of speech should be, with all the knowledge that you have, you should first get the knowledge about the things, and then you are free to give your opinion about that. For example, generally what happens is people look at the actions that ISIS did, or Daesh is doing, or Taliban, all these extremists, whom even the Muslim community, they are against it, who are doing their, whose actions are against the teachings of Quran. Now, when they're against the teachings of the Quran, the Muslims are denying them, why then those people who say we have the freedom of speech, they are just propagating these people only as being a Muslim? So, you know, there is a problem in this term,
right,
in this definition. And when we solve this problem, obviously, then we can have a freedom of speech. For example, Islam also talks about freedom of speech. You're free to talk about anything. You're free to, like, have your opinion about anything, your expressions about anything.
To argue and debate,
yes,
and discuss.
But there are limitations. First, you need to have full knowledge about that thing. That's the very first basic thing. Now, when we look at the freedom of speech, so, for example, we had this thing that happened a couple of months ago, you know, a student who beheaded his teacher in France. There was a Chechen, like in the news, they said he was a Chechen Muslim. So what was the scenario, basically?
Well, he was a France citizen?
Yes.
A French citizen.
He was a French citizen, and the teacher, basically, as the news said, obviously, he showed the naked, sorry to say this for the Muslim brothers, he showed the naked picture of the Prophet of Muslims in the class.
So
and he
called,
was sitting.
So-called picture
so-called
of the Prophet.
So-called picture,
yeah,
of the Prophet. And then he was sitting there
as
being
insulting,
a Muslim.
Yeah.
Yes, obviously. Now, here is insult. Here is insult and direct attack.
It has nothing to do with freedom of speech.
This is not freedom of speech.
When you insult 1.5 billion Muslims.
Number one, how much do you know about the Prophet of Muslims? How much you studied about him? He is Rahmatul Lil Alameen, for example, mercy of all worlds, who was called as the most truthful and the trustworthy person.
But that
person.
Might not be that important for that person X.
So
I don't care about what I know. I have a principle, and that is that according to me, I can show this picture without retaliation because it is freedom of speech, so-called.
Without having a fear of retaliation, there was a fear.
Yeah.
Can he show that publicly? He was showing it to his class.
Right.
That was the main argument. Like, he was in a room, but in that room there were Muslim students as well.
Right. He had anti-Islamic feelings.
He has anti-Islamic feelings.
No doubt. Yeah.
Yes.
And it had nothing.
Because he has anti-Islamic feelings, he was anti. Obviously, because of that, he was against the Prophet of Muslims. But on top of that, you first need to study about the Prophet, how he was. If you want to express your freedom of speech, you cannot show fake things about someone. Mm.
But even the president of the president of France came after that incident and said that Islam essentially has something to do with terrorism, which got a very, very negative feedback.
Yes,
from
because
the Muslim world.
He forgot about the Christianity. Statement. He forgot about the Christianity, yeah. The Crusade Wars and all those things that happened, obviously.
Exactly.
How the West was
but
making
I just
people
wanna,
slaves,
exactly,
how divine people
the cross
make black
Atlantic
people.
Slave trade, yes. Colonialism.
So basically,
I just want to clarify for our listeners that
we're not confirming the action of that person. It should be solved by law or through law.
So I want to make it very clear for our dear listeners that we do not confirm in any means the action of that Muslim who did such an act. That should be according to the law or according to the law of God for the hereafter, if you cannot do anything about it.
And obviously, we should not say like he was a Muslim. Obviously, he was a French citizen. Muslim citizen. This teacher, who was a French teacher, he should look at the obviously people who were in his class.
The sensitiveness of his actions.
That person who is in the class
the
is
also the sensitiveness of the crowd.
Of the crowd, obviously,
right.
And he should see like how far can he go? There are the limitations. Obviously, freedom of speech. You know, when we talk about the freedom of speech, there is a problem. The problem is, we say he is free from all aspects, and this is wrong. Even a human being cannot be free in a country. There are some laws, there are some rules.
Right.
You know,
if you have
a driving license, you're free to drive, yes?
Right, but not however you want.
Yeah, but that's the point. That's the point. We need to bring these limitations
into... So there are
into,
rules
yes.
and limitations of freedom of speech, but that's where we have the problem.
Yes.
Because in liberal democracies today and modernism, the ideology of modernism today, or post-modernism, we do not have anything called holy. Mm-hmm. And there is the conflict between the Muslim Ummah and the Western globe, the Western hemisphere, the Western world, where they have liberal democracy with these kind of views about holiness. There is nothing holy anymore.
There's nothing, especially in the freedom.
So thus I can do whatever I want with the prophets. But let me ask you, Sayyid, as a class where I want to inform my crowd, my students, and now the teacher assumed that he is a Muslim, I want to introduce those pictures. And we know, me and you, that this is not the picture of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi, but he has a turban of bombs and I don't know this and that. And can you not show those images of so-called Prophet Muhammad, which isn't the Prophet, as an information or as informing the class, educating the class?
Well, there are two.
Now we're talking about Muslims. Yes. Imagine that all the class is Muslims, and the teacher is a Muslim too. I want to inform you that these images exist. I have to show you them.
What?
Now, the intention is very different here.
I know. There are two things. Number one is, because it is not the actual picture of the prophet, you should never show this. Obviously, you know, when you're not sure, and you definitely are sure that these pictures do not relate to the XYZ person. He is not him. You cannot bring a fake picture to show. That's one. Obviously, we all are sensible. We all have emotions. And especially when you have love in regards to someone, if you show such pictures and you say, for example, like, in this country or that country, those people, they are showing these things. You know, the way between, like, you know, the Wahhabis or Salafis are killing the innocent Muslims. We have the Shia killings as well. On the same basis, what they do is they bring different, for example, examples in the class where there are the people, these extremists. The fake examples they bring, and then they show, like, look, the Muslims are doing this, the Shias are doing this. You need to, and whenever someone looks at this, obviously they think they must die. Obviously they're insulting my prophet, the most beloved thing that I have. You know, let me make this easy for you to imagine. Can in a family where there is a family, father, son, daughter, like, for example, a father has 4 sons and 2 daughters and a wife, can someone in the absence of the father brings the naked picture or the bombing picture or something like that of that guardian or the father of the house and show them to the people of the house, for example, his sons and daughters and his wife, that this is how others are looking at your, for example, father? What would be the reaction at that time? You can imagine.
Right.
They will become emotional. So you cannot do this. It's unethical. You know?
If we think from another perspective, what would the Prophet himself do? If the Prophet was there in the class, if the Prophet has been insulted, how would he react?
Well,
we have that in our history.
When the person himself is there,
can we take that as a role model?
No. The point is, when the person himself is in that, you can say, crowd, he can save himself. He can talk.
He can defend himself.
He can defend himself.
He can tell.
But obviously, you cannot blame someone when he's absent. You cannot blame someone or bring fake pictures or the things which are not related to him in the class, and you say, it is very easy to do this. It is very easy to bring fake pictures or things like that and blame someone on the basis of what you have just heard, and it does not exist in the history, because, you know, people will not go and follow the history. They do not, for example, Arabic language to read, or the Persian, or the languages which has narrated the history of the Prophet, for example. So this is unethical, totally unethical.
All right.
When a person is not there, you should not.
We will talk about this issue much more in other programs, inshallah ta'ala.
Inshallah.
Thank you very much, Sayyid, and thank you, dear listeners, for joining us in this program. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب آل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Nowhere in the U.S. experienced more HC smoke during the summer of 2020 than Portland, Oregon, where Homeland Security and Border Patrol forces deployed at least 26 such munitions against BLM protesters in July 2020. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Laura Jared, journalist. This article is published under the heading U.S. Police Deployed Potentially Lethal Chemical During Black Lives Matter Protest. Stay tuned for the details, please. $33, you can buy a Defense Technologies hexachloroethane or HC smoke canister for crowd control purposes. This is what the city of Milwaukee paid per unit for 60 max smoke canisters in preparation for the Democratic National Convention in August 2020. It is what Portland police bought in 2018 and what Denver police likely used on Black Lives Matter protesters this summer. However, nowhere in the U.S. experienced more HC smoke during the summer of 2020 than Portland, Oregon, where Homeland Security and Border Patrol forces deployed at least 26 such munitions against BLM protesters in July 2020. BLM protesters were no strangers to tear gas and smoke. After all, the Portland police had gassed them many times since the George Floyd protest began in late May. But once the feds arrived, protesters knew almost immediately that something was different. People reported new strange effects that lasted days or weeks after exposure. "I puked all night," Gregory McClevey, activist and campaign manager for Portland mayoral candidate Sarah Enorens, tweeted on July 26th. "This gas feels different and it sneaks up on you." Other protesters and journalists on the ground reported similar bouts of nausea and vomiting, along with loss of appetite, hair loss, and a burning sensation that lasted days after exposure. Dr. Jennifer L. Simonis, a Portland-based ecologist and evolutionary biologist, suspected that a new chemical used by federal agents might explain these troubling elements. To find out, they collected and tested samples from plants, soil, gas, mask filters, and protesters' clothing. Ultimately, they discovered this chemical, while relatively new to Portland, was not new at all. Nor were its side effects unprecedented. On the contrary, scientists and doctors have known about HC smoke and its potentially lethal side effects for nearly a century. The opportunistic use of smoke or fog in battle to conceal movement and supplies is as ancient as war itself. Chemical smoke, however, originated in the First World War, when E.F. Berger developed the precursor to HC canisters for France. The munition, which combined powdered zinc and carbon tetrachloride to generate opaque clouds of molten zinc chloride smoke, was intended to obscure troop movements, not for crowd control. During the interwar years, scientists stabilized the smoke canister by replacing carbon tetrachloride with hexachloroethane or HC. The improved smoke device still generated zinc chloride along with the smaller quantities of phosgene and carbon monoxide. The munition saw heavy use in the Second World War as a way to obscure harbors, hide supply routes, or signal to other units. Reports of lethal danger of HC smoke, especially in enclosed areas, began accumulating almost immediately. In 1943, 70 people exposed to HC munitions smoke developed nausea, vomiting, chest tightness, and a cough. 10 victims died in the incident. According to a study published in 1954, an 18-year-old man spent 6 weeks in a hospital after 10 minutes of HC smoke exposure in an enclosed space. In a 1963 report, this report found that a fireman died after exposure to the smoke. Numerous reports from 1980s showed the dangers of HC exposure. Two elderly women exposed to zinc chloride for 75 minutes fell violently ill, one of whom eventually died. Two soldiers exposed to the smoke required ventilators after inhalation. A 21-year-old man took 2 months to recover from HC smoke. A different zinc chloride incident killed two men. Five soldiers experienced severe symptoms after breathing HC smoke. Two of these men developed acute respiratory distress syndrome and died. Evidence of the often deadly hazards of HC smoke accumulated within the civilian world as well. In 2017, scientists conducted a survey of academic documentation of HC smoke exposure and found that of 31 documented cases, 8 victims died and 3 experienced permanent lung injury. The clear and well-established danger of high concentrations of HC smoke inspired the military to issue strict guidelines around its use in 1983. When deploying HC munitions, military personnel must wear gas masks. They must restrict HC deployment to areas of the installation as far as practically possible from populated areas and take special precautions to protect higher risk individuals such as those highly allergic, children, and the aged. So why are police forces across the United States using HC smoke in densely populated urban areas against protesters? According to Simonis research, federal agents deployed at least 26 HC smoke munitions in downtown Portland throughout late July. While the canisters were deployed outside, which certainly prevented many deaths, diffusion was limited by crowds of thousands of people, closed tree canopies, cars, and tents, Simonis said. Little wonder protesters and those who lived in the affected areas reported the same list of symptoms HC smoke victims have reported for the last 80 years. Nausea, vomiting, appetite loss, and respiratory distress. The use of respiratory irritants during the COVID-19 pandemic is especially concerning. According to a statement by the Oregon Health and Science University, chemical means to control crowds has raised great concern among medical professionals as we simultaneously try to manage a global pandemic. Respiratory damage not only has the potential to increase infection rates, but can also lead to more severe cases when infection occurs. Even if federal agents never again fill the streets of downtown Portland with clouds of toxic zinc chloride, the consequences of its prolific deployment may haunt the City of Roses for many years to come. HC Smoke releases heavy metals along with zinc chloride. These elements bioaccumulate in livers and kidneys, where they increase the chance of cancer. This kind of damage may not be evident for many years, but those who live downtown or protected for black lives in the summer of 2020 may be at a higher risk of kidney and liver problems down the road. Simonis is also concerned about the long-term effects of these chemicals on the environment. Their analysis of soil, plants, and storm drains reveal a far higher concentration of heavy metals than comparable sites elsewhere in the area. Soil samples from affected areas contain higher than normal amounts of cyanide and chromium. Samples taken in the August from storm drains, which lead directly to the Willamette River, contained almost 10 times more toxins than comparable sites. Harmful chemicals such as barium, chromium, copper, lead, and zinc all seem posed to contaminate Oregon's ecosystem. Simonis is especially worried about zinc chloride, which causes bone deformities in young fish and thereby threatens Oregon salmon, a staple of both commercial fisheries and protected sea lions. Dr. Paul Trotnick, a chemist and professor at OHSU's School of Public Health, agrees that heavy metals may have a deleterious effects on Willamette or Columbia Rivers short term, but believes the environmental impact will fade with time. In the long run, the contamination is not really going to be noticeable because all these sediments are going to settle out in the bottom of Portland Harbor. Portland Harbor, already contaminated with chemical runoff from other disasters, will not be made significantly worse by heavy metal runoff from chemical munitions. Trotnick agrees, however, that HC smoke munitions are highly dangerous when used as crowd control. I was surprised that it was nearly unrestricted for police to use these kinds of munitions on protesters. Trotnick says any good faith review of the subject must result in restrictions on what sort of chemicals police may use against protesters.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.